This is an ABC podcast.
Today it's part two of Tim Cope's epic story. It's a story that's actually kind of like an ancient fable, but it's all true. In 2004, Tim Cope set out on horseback from the ancient capital of Mongolia. Laid out in front of him was the Great Eurasian Steppe, a series of vast grassy plains and mountain passes that runs right across Asia and into Europe. This was the path taken by the soldiers of Genghis Khan, and Tim wanted to know what it was like to ride in the saddle across a great big land without fences, living like a Mongol nomad, travelling all the way to Hungary. He did it, and it took him 3 years. He grappled with thieves and wolves. He received so much kind hospitality from people who completely connected with what he was trying to do, and he fell in love as well. Last time, Tim told the story of the first half of his journey through Asia, and today we're going to pick up the trail in the oil fields of Kazakhstan and go through Russia, Ukraine, and into Hungary, where Tim finished with his horses on the banks of the Danube River. Tim's book is called On the Trail of Genghis Khan. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Richard.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Now, we left you in Kazakhstan, in this kind of frozen hellhole of a place, and then you went past the Aral Sea, which is more like the Aral Puddle these days, sadly. How did the land now change again once you started to enter into that territory around the oil fields of Kazakhstan?
At that stage, I was probably a year and a half into the journey. I'd been riding through this desert landscape where it was 40 degrees to 50 degrees day after day. I was riding through the night. It was very difficult, in fact. I'd try to ride till sunrise, but invariably I'd fall off and sleep for a couple of hours here or there, or fall asleep in the saddle. And the key was to find shelter before this great big fiery ball came back up in the sky, and I learnt to fear the sun, which was, of course, the opposite to winter when there was no sun.
What was it like riding at nights through such a place?
I really, on one hand, came to love it. It was a time when you felt like the world was sleeping. You were moving alone, almost as if you were tiptoeing through the landscape, as if no one knew you were there. And that really gave me that great sense that I had throughout this trip, that no one ever really knew where I was, and it didn't really matter where I was. As long as I had grass and water, I wasn't lost. But to think that I could move into people's lives, arrive in a village on someone's doorstep in a state of disrepair, and they had no preconceptions, no warning that I was coming. I just enter as I was, and they take me as I was. It was, in those split seconds, there was a connection and a sense of camaraderie almost that developed in these big, hostile environments.
What was the basis of that connection? Why did people connect with you?
It was totally unexpected on one hand to see this person appear, but on the other hand, I was almost a shadow of their ancestors. Here I was carrying out this nomadic life that their parents, their grandparents had lived, and I was moving through the landscape, experiencing what they inherently knew, going through the process of looking for grass and water for my horses. They say in Kazakh that first time as a guest you're a friend, second time you're part of the family, third time you can stay for life. And they kind of took me in like some kind of long-lost son. And of course, whether it be the Kazakhs, whether it be the Kalmyks later in Russia, the Tatars in Crimea, the Magyars in Hungary, my journey symbolised for them something of their own unique nomadic culture. Of course, the Magyars from Hungary, they rode out from what is now southern Siberia, northern Kazakhstan in the 9th century, arrived in Hungary on their horses, created what is modern-day Hungary. The Tatars were once a nomad people. The Kalmyks have their own unique history, their own unique past as rulers of the steppe. The Mongols, keeping in mind, were just one of many, many nomadic peoples that created empires. And so to each different culture, I meant something slightly different. But invariably, I reminded them a little bit of their past and their culture, and they took interest in me because I was taking pride in their culture.
And when you weren't able to be taken into a house during the day in this blistering 40, 50-degree heat, what would you do? Where would you sleep during the day?
It was like death not to find somewhere. But if I did, there were occasions when I had to set up the inner tent, and then I'd just drape the inner tent with all of my felt blankets and saddle pads and create that insulating effect that's similar to a nomad yurt, in fact. Because in that dry heat, it's not so much staying cool. It's about imagine putting your hand in an oven without a mitt on. You know, you need to dress up and protect yourself from this.
Or from dehydration.
From the heat that they say in Russia, you know, the heat literally beats you up.
Is there much shade to be found in the middle
of
the day?
No, there isn't. There's literally very few trees. And so the tent was the only shade that I had.
And the horses and your dog Tigon, how were they faring in this heat?
For the horses, like for me, the summer was the hardest time. And the winter, by comparison, was a cinch because you've got a layer of snow on the ground, which means you can travel in whichever direction you want. The horses eat the snow. And that's, of course, why winter was always the season for war. It's why the Mongols always made their campaigns in autumn and winter. It's a time when the horses are at their peak. They've got their freedom to go well away from wells and rivers and lakes, which are very hard to find, and especially in that central part of the Eurasian steppe in Kazakhstan. So getting back to your original question about arriving in the oil fields, I'd been for months on end in living by these rhythms of the landscape dictated by this really harsh weather. But that was nothing compared to the hostility that I found as I rode into a town called Kulsari. And Kulsari was one of the towns going through this great oil boom that is still occurring in Western Kazakhstan in the Caspian region. I just had these vivid memories of riding in my big, strong, proud horse, Taskinir, who'd got me through all these troubles. He was trembling to see these big trucks just barreling past, shooting up the gravel, spraying it all over us. We stayed with a guy, Tanbai, who'd mistakenly thought we were arriving by car, and he took us into the middle of the town. We tied the horses up.
What did he make of you showing up with a bunch of horses?
His face went pale because, I mean, first of all, where is he going to put these horses? And of course, all we could do was tie them up in his little backyard in the boiling heat, where they presently began, of course, to build big piles of manure. And the aim was to find somewhere to leave the horses. At that time, I had to go back and get a visa for Russia and so forth. He was in this boxed-in little mud house surrounded by these mansions that were very quickly being built. There was still no good road infrastructure or anything like that. There was no water, no running water. There were lines and queues and lines of water tankers where you could go out and order a load of water to be brought to your house. So he had these mansions with pit toilets out the back, but obviously a lot of wealth, a lot of Land Cruisers driving around, a lot of people who were visibly starting to aspire to a very different kind of life than what I'd been immersed in. There's a certain prestige attached, of course, to working in the oil industry, and that takes away from the prestige that was once attached to traditional values of being a great herder, of having a big herd, of being a great horseman. And it just adds to that effect that had already begun, well and truly begun, in the Soviet era, whereby nomadism is kind of marginalised and looked down upon as kind of some primitive, rather uncultured way of life. And Caspian Sea is very rich in oil. I mean, the finds that they've had there are some of the biggest finds of oil in the last 10 or 20 years. Chevron from America came in the early 90s after the collapse of the Soviet era, negotiated an agreement with the Kazakh government to develop this big oil field. And basically the Kazakh government relies on the oil to run the country. And in the process, of course, like in a lot of these countries, whether it be Russia, Mongolia, Ukraine, there is endemic corruption. And there's a perception, at least, that the money gets funneled back to Astana and the capital in the east of the country, and not much gets left behind for the local people. But there is this violent intersection of nomadic way of life with this new booming oil economy. And the risk, of course, is that it's the economic marginalisation of nomadic society and the nomadic herding economy that I witnessed.
But still there are remnants of that society. Tell me how you came upon the mysterious horse blanket you'd heard about.
I was riding west from Kulsari towards the Russian border, actually following the oil pipeline that's delivering all these millions and millions of barrels of oil to the coast on the Azov Sea. And next to the oil line, it was passing through nomad societies, through villages and towns. And I came across this man whose family, he'd grown up in the sand dunes just to the north in a place called the Narin Kum. And he had this remarkable saddle blanket that was made fully of the horsehair of the horse's tail and the mane. And you need about five horses to make this saddle
blanket. Five horses worth of manes and tails to make this blanket.
Yeah.
So why would you make a blanket out of horse hair and horse mane?
Well, I mean, I've been told about this mysterious blanket from day one in Mongolia. Everyone seemed to inherently know that a blanket made of horse hair is the best saddle blanket for going long distances. It creates much less friction on the horse's back. It doesn't retain water. It drains very quickly.
So you can go through streams and...
That's right. You can go through rain or through a stream and then pop out the other side. It will drain away and there won't be any of those issues you get with friction and saddle sores. And it's called a kiltetlik, which means like a horse's underwear.
A horse's underwear.
Essentially.
Is this a secret that was used by the campaigning nomad armies of Genghis Khan's time?
Well, it seemed to be. It was the first place, and it was the only place in my 10,000 Ks where I just encountered it. And it makes sense to me that that's how, partly, how Mongols were able to cross rivers and vast spaces and just keep going. Because anyone knows now on the steppe that if you use a felt blanket or anything else, if it gets drenched, it'll take days to dry out. And it will very quickly create saddle sores. And it was like this miraculous connection to the past, but adjacent to this great, giant, big oil pipeline that was running right through the middle of the desert on its way to the west.
You started the journey with your girlfriend at the time, Catherine, who was from Germany, and she joined you for the first 2 months of the journey. Then she had to go back, and you were in contact with her. She'd been ill. She had to go to hospital, but you kept on your journey because you'd been planning for it for years before you'd met her. You wrote that around about this time you began to think it was a good idea to actually break up with her. How did you actually break the news to her, and how did that go? That must have been a kind of a painful and awkward period.
Yeah, it was. I mean, probably more painful for her at the time. She'd been in Germany waiting for me. I'd been on the road then for 18 months or so, and she'd fallen ill during the journey with Cushing's syndrome, which is fatal unless treated fairly urgently. So she had to have brain surgery and a tumour cut out of her brain. So she'd never been able to come back and join me in any of those her summer holidays that was the original plan. But I guess far above and beyond not being able to see her, I was at a stage where I didn't want the horizon to be predetermined. I quite enjoyed the fact, I was beginning to enjoy the fact that my original plan of reaching Hungary in 18 months had already failed. I mean, and eventually the trip, of course, took 3.5 years. And I probably, I just simply wasn't ready to commit to her in that way. I didn't feel ready for that. And I told her by satellite phone. I called her up. And it was very awkward. And we went through a difficult period. And my link to sanity was always to get back on the horses and keep riding. The horses were always my way of moving on, digesting things.
What is it about that forward motion on horseback that seems to untangle those kind of emotional knots?
It pares life down to its bare essentials, and also, of course, that sense of movement, it negates any sense of stagnation. But unfortunately what happened is that I went from Atrau at the time on the Caspian Sea, got to the Russian border, crossed over triumphantly to the Russian post, and of course the vet looked me up, dragged me into this little shipping container of an office and told me that in fact I didn't have enough papers, I'd have to go back. I spent the night in between the two borders, arrived back in Kazakhstan, and the custom officers there wouldn't let me back into Kazakhstan. They told me that, in fact, I'd illegally exported the horses the previous day.
Man, there was no way anyway, no matter what you did to prepare, when you came to the Russian border crossing, that you were going to have adequate paperwork to get into Russia with three horses and a dog. I thought, gee, he's confident and optimistic, thinking no matter, you know, you could have had Vladimir Putin next to you and you wouldn't have gotten into Russia, I've got the feeling.
It's a minefield.
How long did it take to sort out?
Well, I then got stuck for 6 weeks until the very last day of my Kazakh visa, when I would have had to abandon my horses and get out of the country anyway. And it was an incredible process where I became a member of the local Ministry of Agriculture, sending faxes and making phone calls to Moscow and Astana. I had a whole team of people helping me. And then 2 days before my visa expired, I got a permit, and then I got a devastating response immediately from the border. They said, "You do not have permission to ride your horses. You only have permission to take them by train and transit Russia." Literally, with 1 day to go, I'd given up. I was very dejected. I didn't have any opportunity to speak with Catherine at this time, and I really missed then her companionship and her support. She'd gone to Italy to a remote place to spend her holidays, and
things are really bad then.
Things were really bad. I thought I was about to lose my horses and my dog. I'd broken up with my girlfriend. What have I done? I'm reduced to nothing. But then I came crawling back to the ministry to say goodbye to the people. The door was a bit ajar, which I thought was strange. Went in, and this lady who I thought had gone to lunch break was still there. And she just about burst into tears and brought me this paper. And she'd managed to get this fax from Moscow, which said, Tim Cope, traveller, now has permission to ride his horses through Russia, and his dog will be transported on his own four legs. and with that, I was able to go to the border. And there was this interesting thing then where I crossed the border at 11 o'clock at night, an hour before my visa expired. The Russian border was closed by then. I camped in between the two borders, by which stage there was no way back. And fortunately, I sailed through the next day and into Russia.
And you got into Astrakhan, the city of Astrakhan. And while you were there, I just love this story. You lost control of your horses and they bolted. Tell me how you found your missing horses in the streets of Astrakhan.
Well, I thought I'd been through all of the hardship. I got through the deserts, the winters, the border. And Russia kind of beckoned with the promise of a slightly more temperate landscape, a culture that was a bit more familiar to my own, you know, Russian sedentary people. However, I hadn't bargained on this city, of course, and the horses had bolted in the middle of the night with all my gear, my diaries, my films that I've been recording for 2-3 years. And the policemen, they went out and helped me. I put petrol in the car and emergency services came out. With no luck. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was sleeping in the police station. In fact, they put me in a cell and put a bed in there for me. And this officer shook me awake and said, Tim, I've just had a dream.
A police officer told you he'd had a dream?
Yes, he said, yes. I've just been fishing and I caught a red fish, a grey fish and a black fish, the same colour as your three horses. I just know this time we're going to find them. And so he went outside and got in his old Russian Jeep. And sure enough, out near this old Russian Air Force base, we picked up a trail of all of my gear that had been gradually falling off the horses. And at the end of it, there was Ogonyok, my five-year-old pack horse, and Taskinir. Their saddles had swung around to their tummies, their blankets had become big nappies. Poor Ogonyok's big pack box was hanging down from under his tummy. He couldn't move forward, back, or sit down or anything. And policemen walked up, this big machine gun over his shoulder, and kissed his nose.
Kissed the nose of Ogonyok.
Of Ogonyok, and it was just a reminder that these misadventures generally somehow ended up with a sense of friendship, and I was able to keep going.
All throughout your journey, there's these kind of important dreams that either you have or someone else has, and the whole journey seems kind of dreamlike. Is that something you want to think too hard about?
Well, in all honesty, whether it be in Mongolia, Kazakhstan, particularly as I moved further west towards Europe, settled Europe, when the horses had become an extension of my own body, it was like being on the horses allowed me to not only transcend the modern era and go back to the past and understand what it was like, it also enabled me to tap into a world and also a generosity of spirit of people that would otherwise have gone completely invisible to me. And it's a kind of reminder for me that in the modern era, of course, you can jump in a plane from Mongolia, be in Hungary in 6 hours, we can get in a plane in Australia and be in Europe in 24 hours, but there is no substitute for that sense of journey.
Do you think there's something about the nature of your journey that would encourage a policeman with a machine gun to wake you up and say, I've had a dream about three different coloured fish that are the same as your horses, and now I know we will find them? Do you think there was something about the nature of your journey that would otherwise not make him quite so inclined to wake you up about a dream he'd had, and then find the horses too?
I think when people got a sense of the scale of the journey and what I was trying to do, some had pity on me, some thought I was crazy, but most kind of empathised with me. And even that policeman in question, he was actually of Kazakh descent, and for him it was a matter of pride. He couldn't cope with the fact that if we didn't find the horses, that area of Astrakhan and where he'd grown up and where his heritage was would forever be tainted, because it was the place where traveller Tim Cope lost his horses, and it was the end of this journey to Europe.
He'll tell his grandchildren that story about how he found the three horses of the young Australian adventurer through a dream. Moving on through southern Russia, you entered into this fabled place called Kalmykia that I didn't even know existed. What makes Kalmykia special, Tim?
Well, Kalmykia is a republic in southern Russia. I mean, Russia's a country made up of many republics, but this one is actually the only Buddhist republic in geographical Europe.
It's the only Buddhist... there is a Buddhist nation in geographical Europe, and that is Kalmykia.
Yeah, and the Kalmyks are, in fact, of Mongol descent. And I'd been told about the Kalmyks in Europe by the Oirats of Western Mongolia a year earlier, just before I'd left Western Mongolia. And of course, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, they have an opportunity, like many other minorities I witnessed as well, to revive their culture.
So what were they telling you when you were there about reviving their culture?
There were many different philosophies on how best to revive Kalmyk culture. I met the head lama of this new temple that had been built. In fact, it's the largest Buddhist temple in Europe as well. And his belief was that religion was at the heart of restoring the culture and the pride. However, I also met Okna Tsahanzam, who is a famous Kalmyk singer whose pop songs have actually reached the number one in the charts in Mongolia. He uses a mix of traditional and modern music. And he was fervently of the belief that the Kalmyks needed to return to their past before the introduction of Buddhism, to the era of shamanism and the pure nomadic way of life. So there were many conflicting ways, but the overwhelming feeling was that whether it be librarians gathering Kalmyk literature, whether it be Okna Tsahanzam trying to inspire people to return to their ancient past, or the rise of Buddhism again and the building of hundreds of temples, there was a very strong feeling that they had an opportunity in modern Russia to try to restore what had once been a great khanate.
In Timishevsk, the border with Ukraine, you met this kind of local gangster, a guy called Luty. How did he come into your presence? How did he make himself known to you, Tim?
I was riding through spring. I was getting pretty desperate at that stage. I hadn't washed in several weeks. My clothes were falling apart. There was mud everywhere. The horses were molting. The hair was sticking to my clothes. People were starting to refuse me entry into shops to buy bread. It was so bad. And up ahead lay Ukraine, and I needed to somehow get permits, and I had no idea how I was going to do this in my state. And that was when this great big black Range Rover appeared from nowhere. He got out and said, "Follow, fellow Cossack, I'll help you, but first promise me you'll have a wash." And Luty turned out to be the owner of a massive collective farm that employed 2,000 or 3,000 people. He was the local member of parliament. He was the local mayor.
He looks like a cartoon gangster. I mean, there's a picture of him in your book, and he's got the dark sunglasses, the black suit. Yeah. Is he trying to dress like a gangster, or is that just how guys dress around that part of Russia and Ukraine?
I think it was a matter of prestige and a matter of pride. He saw himself, and he was a very powerful man, and he dressed like it, and he used to order me into his office and pull out a $100 bill and say, "Here, go and buy some cigarettes or something."
Why was he so eager to help you, do you think?
I think for a lot of these people, believe it or not, in me they saw a glimpse of something that a part of them probably wanted to do themselves, particularly as Cossacks, as a people who once prided their life as horseback riders. And
so that's why he said, "Hello, fellow
cavaliers.
Cossack to you."
That's right. To me, I was living the life that Cossacks were meant to live, but of course the Kuban steppe has long been ploughed up and turned into a big wheat belt.
All the way along, you're being offered lots of vodka to drink, and you could sort of keep up with that to some degree. But also, and particularly here, guys like Luty kept on offering you prostitutes again and again and again, and you would say no, 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 and no. How comfortable are you in that kind of hypermasculine, you know, Sopranos type atmosphere? We drink vodka, we take whores, we do this because we are men. How are you going with all that, Tim?
I guess I found it really quite uncomfortable, because I was told time and time again, "Oh, just relax, Tim, come on, you worry too much. Just come and have a sauna with us and you can choose whatever girl you'd like, it's fine." And
I mean, you've been out there for quite a long while on your own and living a pretty chaste existence.
Much of this journey was a physical challenge, but in Timishevsk it was more an internal challenge, and also a realisation that how my own upbringing in Gippsland had probably shaped the way I viewed the world. I found myself among these men with values that weren't wrong or right, they were just simply different. And by this stage of the journey, it wasn't as if I could just ride on. I was speaking fluent Russian. I was learning to live within this system that's riddled with corruption. I was far too close to this society to be able to really detach myself from it, and I felt myself being pulled into it. And the thing is that someone like Luti, he was my key to moving on and getting out of here. These were the same system, and these same values were the same values that were enabling me to move on, get new horses and get through the bureaucracy, of course. And it's all to do with, in some ways, corruption and connections, and I guess prostitution and alcohol has partly filled the vacuum in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet era. And I later had a very revealing conversation with a priest in the area who said, "A wound on the body heals fast. A wound in the spirit takes years to recover, but a wound in the spirit of an entire people takes centuries to recover from."
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So, Tim, you crossed over the border into Crimea. It's a Crimea in Ukraine, and you rode your horse into the town of Bakhchysarai. And as you rode into town, you wrote, you saw a woman, Anya. What kind of vision did Anya present to your tired, weary eyes at that point?
I came riding down into this, on dusk, into this beautiful old town that was actually the old capital of the Tatar Khanate. And there before me was this long, flowing blonde hair, tall, summer, so she's dressed in shorts and a singlet or something, and she's carrying this, an easel under her hand and a paintbrush. And she caught my eye, and I stopped, and she came up and she asked, "What's the colour of your horse? What's the name of that?" And it was Chestnut, which in Russian is Rizhi. And I kept moving and clinging to this image of her as I went into the centre to the Khan's palace. I spent the next several weeks in Bakhchysarai, which is in the heart of Crimea. But within the first half hour, I'd met the main kind of protagonist, if you like, that had filled my life for that period. And I met Anya. I met this guy, Volodya, a Tatar, who was married to a Russian and had built himself a kind of hovel hut on the outskirts of town. His family had come back from exile. I went into the palace, and this was a place where the old Khans used to sit and have their guests and so forth. And then down the street there was this big conflict going on at the market. There was a picket line, and these were the things that I moved between. And of course, as I entered the Khan's palace, there in front of me, this was about half an hour later, there in front of me was this girl in the back of the garden painting the palace on her easel, and I walked up and said hello, and she said, "You walked into my painting."
Wow, that's a pretty good line. That's fantastic. You wrote that you fell in love quite quickly, and how much time did you get to spend with her?
I think it was a couple of weeks. We spent our time mostly exploring the hills and the caves above Bakhchysarai. It was like some time out from my journey, because just down the road were my horses, and I became quite engaged with this conflict that was going on between Tatars that are returning from exile as of about 1989, and the Russians who don't really want them to return. They're a kind of symbol of the returning Mongols in a way. Yeah, it was like a part of me came to life that had been somewhere hidden and dormant for a long time. And it was very sad the day that she got on the train and went back to Kiev. And I kept in contact with her. In fact, we stayed together for the next 12 months, as it turned out. And she'd come and visit me from time to time.
Once you got out of the peninsula, the Crimean Peninsula, into the Ukrainian mainland, I suppose, if that's the word for it, I don't know, you were contacted by Australian Geographic magazine, and you were told that you were going to be their Adventurer of the Year. which is this really weird moment. So then you took a pause on this big journey and flew into Sydney to receive this award. I think I spoke to you at this time, actually, on radio, as you were, you'd just come back briefly to receive this award for as Australian Geographic Adventurer of the Year. You got to spend some time with your family then, briefly, in Sydney during this period, didn't you?
It was just a remarkable time. Out of the blue, flown to Sydney. My father and mother came up. My great uncle, who lives in the hinterland of the Gold Coast, came down. He's been a great supporter of mine as well. And we had this wonderful celebration. We had lunch with Dick Smith and many other people. And it was, my dad was kind of swelling in pride because, as someone who at the age of 19 quit my law degree at ANU, went overseas and kind of decided to pursue this quite uncertain way of life, this was a moment where it all crystallised, and he was so proud of me, and he almost come to see me as a man. That's the way I felt. And I got this last glimpse of him getting into a taxi with my mum, just watching this taxi heading off into the traffic the day before I flew back to the Ukraine.
So then back in the Ukraine, you get back on the horse and you resume your journey after this strange little interlude in Sydney. And 2 days out from Kadima, you got the biggest shock of the whole journey. Where were you when you got that message to call home?
I was riding in the evening, looking for a place as normal to camp, probably about two-thirds of the way through Ukraine, and this beeping came in my backpack, and I realised I'd left a satellite phone on. I pulled it out of my bag. It was a message that had come from my brother, and it just said, call home immediately. So I leapt off the horse and called home. And the moment that a friend of the family answered the phone, I knew that something was wrong. Mum eventually got on the phone, and I learnt then that my dad had been in a car accident earlier that day, and he'd died. And at that point, this whole journey that had become overwhelming in my life just vanished before me. I'm the oldest of four kids, and although I'd been alone on this trip, I'd never really been alone. I'd still had this father there. At that point, there was like these two separate beings that came into being in me. There was the traveller Tim, who had to look after finding camp and water and making sure the horses were okay, and then the Tim who was just trying to cope with what had happened. The next day I got on a train to Kiev. I left the horses at a collective farm, went to Australia, spent 4.5 months there trying to understand what had happened, deal with it, the grief, not knowing whether I should return and abandon my family or abandon my animals and not go back.
Recent guest on the program was telling me how when she got news when she was in England that her father had died, an unexpected early death, the very first thought that popped into her head was, who's going to watch me now? Did you have that thought too?
My immediate thought was, I've got to go back. I've got to go back to the life where I was his son. I've got to go back to people who knew him. I can't move forward. To move forward to new places would be to move on without him. And I couldn't even think that there wasn't someone watching over. I had to believe that he was still somewhere there. You know, his presence was, whether it be in the mist around me in that morning when I rode back to leave the horses. But then, of course, as time passed and we had the funeral and I returned, there was this moment when I arrived back. It was actually this footprint of my tent where I'd camped in the autumn. At that moment that I now knew Dad had been in the accident. And it was like I knew then riding on from that point into the future was riding on without him and without him watching over, without him there. And suddenly I was in the easiest part of the trip. The deserts and the mountains and the cold was gone. I was looking forward to spring, plenty of grass, plenty of water. And yet life felt more fragile than ever. And I honestly thought I might die before I get to Hungary. And I guess you have those feelings of vulnerability and fragility when someone dies. But for me, it was particularly difficult because I was heading back onto this journey. But it did become a catharsis for me, riding into spring. And as the world came back to life, the blossom came, the grass grew. I felt myself coming back to life. The horses, their health, they'd been locked up in a shack in a barn for 4 or 5 months. They kind of came back to life as well, and we we resumed this great journey, and I learnt to feel that Dad was with me in some ways.
Across the Carpathians into Hungary now. Who was your man on the inside in Hungary, Tim?
There was a man called, well, there was a couple of men, but there was one particularly interesting man called Peter Kuhn. And as I arrived a few hundred kilometres from the Danube, he took me off the horse and said, "Tim, I want to show you something." And he started to tie this knot, and I knew immediately what he was going to do. It was this special knot that I'd been told within the first day of my journey in Mongolia. It's a special way of tying what's similar to a bowline knot that's very, very useful for tying up horses in different occasions. And that knot had seen me through in Kazakhstan. They'd said, "How do you know this knot? It's a Kazakh knot." In Kalmyk era, it was a Kalmyk knot. And here, Peter stood before me and said, "Tim, what you don't understand is that this is the true Hungarian knot, and that people west of the Danube don't know it." And it was like this knot for me that was tying together this ancient past.
A knot that connected Hungary to Mongolia.
Yes.
And then everyone thought it was their own.
That's right. But of course, it all goes back to his common heritage, to probably as far back as the day or the time of the domestication of the horse, at least 5,500 years ago. And Peter Kuhn, for me, was an example perhaps of how I might live in the future, because he was a professor working at a university, but he also lived on the steppe. He had herds of sheep and animals and horses. He even had a Kazakh yurt set up right there that I slept in with Tigan, my dog, who'd been with me by this stage the whole trip for 3 years. And it was this great feeling of circularity, like I've returned back to where I began. And yeah, Peter was for me the standout person.
What did Peter say when he saw your dog and your horse?
He immediately looked at my dog and said, "He's a Tuzzy." And I couldn't believe it, because he was a Tuzzy, and Tuzzy is a special kind of Kazakh sighthound that nomads traditionally use for hunting foxes and rabbits. And he said, "Those horses are Jabi, aren't they?" And Jabi is, of course, the Kazakh breed of nomad horse. They say that the Kazakh nation rode the back of the Jabi. And I'd fulfilled his boyhood dream to ride from Asia to Europe. And he said to me, "Tim," and his friend said to me, "that we think you're a bit crazy as an Australian to do this trip, but we can see in your heart and mind that you've become a nomad like one of us." And to me, that was the crystallisation of the whole journey. The purpose of the trip was to ride from east to west, coming to view the world through the eyes of a nomad.
The Huns were the predecessors of the Mongol hordes. They came from the same part of the world, didn't they? They came out of Central Asia on horseback and rode into Europe and were the terror of the late Roman Empire. Western Europe tends to think of the Huns as being these savages, but in Hungary, they call their kids Attila, don't they?
That's right, and there is great pride in their nomadic past. And the ironic thing is, on the face of it, is that, of course, the Mongols wiped Hungary out in the 13th century. They devastated the place. They slaughtered the people. And so someone arriving in the spirit of the Mongols like me, you wouldn't expect them to be greeting you with much fanfare. However, in reality, with time, all of these nomad empires, whether they be Huns, whether they be Magyars, Mongols, Kalmyks, Kazakhs, Tatars, Kipchaks, they all kind of coalesce into one big brotherhood of nomadic societies. And I was treated like one of them. And I, specifically for the Hungarians, epitomised the journey of their ancestors, the Magyars.
Then you rode in caravan for a week, south towards the Danube. How were your animals faring at this point, at the end of the journey?
At this point, we'd reached the land of plenty. There was so much grass, so much water. The horses were in great shape. They were shiny. They were starting to get their autumn coat. I was starting to go on these long gallops that I'd never really been able to do, because they didn't have enough food. I had to be very careful to conserve their energy. I remember just sitting flush, bareback on Tascanier, galloping along like a bullet, sitting flush on this animal, and it was like the world stood still around me. And thinking back to day one of the journey 3.5 years earlier, when, I couldn't ride a horse and I hadn't even managed to climb on my horse, I'd have to walk out of town, out of Hadahorden, I realised that I would now struggle to live without these animals that had become my whole life.
How are you feeling about the impending end of your journey as far as yourself goes? I mean, about what you'd learned and how you'd changed?
there was that mixed feeling of grief, of course, of exultation that I was reaching the end of this long road. And yet when I reached the Danube waters, I knew then that beyond here begins temperate Europe, begins fences, begins towns, places where horsemen, nomadic people, don't really belong. And so I really had the choice to turn around and start riding back to Mongolia, where I'd come from, or, of course, give my horses up and return to Australia.
And that's what you did. What's the best memory of those last 4 days?
Probably the best memory was when my brother, John, arrived. My father had often talked about coming and joining me. He never made it. But my brother John did eventually commit, and just those last few days he was walking alongside the horse, riding sometimes. In fact, the 2 days before the end of the trip, we were riding after dark, and then up ahead I heard this lady's voice. She said, "Oh, Tegan, is that you?" And it was my mum. And I rode up, and it was amazing, because thinking back to that moment, I'd told my mum about this trip. She'd almost fallen over. She couldn't picture me as a horseman. And here I was riding to the finish and up on my big horse, and I'd made it. And it
you was were that a, guy. You were that guy you'd wanted to become.
Yeah, and I felt like I was emerging from a totally different world, and the sense of togetherness probably would never be repeated with all my friends that had come, but also the togetherness with my animals.
And the last few steps up to the banks of the Danube, where did it end? Paint the picture for me.
There were two endings. There was that lonesome ending on the Danube, just my horses and the dog, when I realised that it was all over. But then there was the ending in Apostosur, which is the town near the Danube, where the Hungarian nation was founded in the 9th century. And the ambassador from Mongolia had come, the ambassador from Kazakhstan, there were several politicians, Hungarian politicians. The Australian ambassador got up there. There was a kind of a guard of honour of Hungarian horsemen in traditional outfit. The Kazakhs and Mongols got up and sung these beautiful songs about horses and the steppe. Then the Australian ambassador, I think he may have been the vice ambassador at the time, got up and sang The Road to Gundagai, which didn't quite fit in, but it didn't matter at that point. And it was one of those rare moments when all of the nomadic peoples came together, and there wasn't any of that infighting that tends to happen between cultures.
The Road to Gundagai can do that to people, can unite disparate people against it, can't it?
Yeah.
How are you feeling? I mean, this is lovely. It sounds like the end of Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or something to some degree. Yeah. But your heart must have been very heavy, though, nonetheless, at the end of this.
Oh, I didn't know if I was going to break out in tears or laughter, and I did all of them within the space of an hour, I think, of finishing. And we went back that night. I didn't have any money at that time. I ran out. I borrowed Mum's credit card to pay for a yurt camp to put all my friends up for the night. There was palinka, which is the Hungarian schnapps, if you like, on tap. There were people roaming around on horses, and this fairly drunken guy called Attila came up to me and said, Tim, first night on the trip in a gur, last night on the trip in a yurt. A gur is a yurt. It's beautiful, beautiful. And well, he didn't call me Tim Cope, he called me something like Kim Pope or something, but it didn't matter. It was just the end.
So it was time to go back to Australia then.
Mm.
What happened to the horses and what happened to Tigon? Because they couldn't get on a plane with you, could they?
No, unfortunately, I gave the horses away at the time for an orphanage. To get Tigon out was impossible. It was going to cost $10,000. He had a Kazakh passport. He had become an EU citizen, which would take 6 months before even being allowed to apply for a permit for Australia. So I left him behind.
Tigon had become an EU citizen? Your dog had become a citizen?
He had to become one. He had to naturalise as a Hungarian in order to apply for a permit for Australia.
Well, so you had to go home without him, in other words?
I went home. I got these phone calls from the farm where I left him to say that Tigon had taken all the local farm dogs chasing a horse rider for 50 kilometres, and this guy was going to have to send a taxi to pick them all up. He'd chased a horse float. And then 12 months passed, and I got this letter in the mail. I opened it up quite nervously, and it was a letter from AQUIS saying that I had a permit. At that time, I was in Perth. Within 2 weeks, I was able to raise almost $10,000 by appealing to the masses and doing some presentations, selling tickets at the door, in a way of getting Tiggin home. Eventually, I got Tiggin in a taxi from Budapest to Vienna. I got him on a plane to Dubai, and from there to Spotswood. I used to call it the detention centre, but it's not, it's the Spotswood quarantine centre, where I met him. And he acknowledged me at once, came running up, put his paws all over me, and then he spent the next hour chewing on the bone that I'd given him, not even looking at me, but that didn't matter.
When you go out and about talking to kids groups in Australia with Tiggin by your side, what kind of response does he get from kids?
Well, a good example was during the Brisbane Writers' Festival, when at the end, of course, it's the first question, what happened to Tiggin? And eventually, when they got to patting, the kids were saying, I'm never washing these hands again. And there were some little Tiggin hairs left, and they were picking every last little hair up and keeping it and saying, I've got Tiggin DNA. No, they love Tiggin, and Tiggin does transcend all cultures, all ages. He's actually the one that guided me through this journey in many ways.
All the way from Kazakhstan to Hungary and then to Australia. After your last appearance on the program, we recorded a bit of Tiggin singing along to the music of Beethoven, which I think is the perfect way to go out on the program today, because Tiggin has many talents. It's been fantastic, Tim. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Tim Cope, on the trail of Genghis Khan. My guest today was Tim Cope, and Tim shared this astonishing story with me in 2013. Since we've spoken, Tim made a documentary series about this adventure, and he's also published a book for young people called Tim and Tiggin. I'm sad to say that Tiggin has now passed away, but his descendants are many, and they live all over Australia. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.